Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
For the first time in 28 years, I was late getting started. Why? Because I got so engaged with my guest that I lost track of the time. I can't think of a better advertisement for my guest than that. Because in my judgment, his topic is the most boring topic in human history. Musicology. To study the intellectualization of this thing that I love so deeply, music. But this is the one guy on the planet, and I've heard a bunch of musicologists over my life, the one guy who not only is not soporific, that has put me to sleep, but the guy that inspires me and keeps me awake and is fun. And so it is with great pleasure. The guy has been on KLW before, in the excellent judgment of the KLW folks. He is probably the world's... No one could call somebody the world's premier musicologist. That's wrong. But he's probably the best communicating musicologist among the 7.4 billion people who are on planet Earth. And therefore, it is my pleasure to introduce Robert Greenberg.
Thank you, Marty. And here, the first thing I'm going to do is disagree with you.
This will not be the last time this morning.
Welcome to our lives together.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not a musicologist. A musicologist is someone who has studied the subject of musicology and has an advanced degree in the subject. I'm a composer. My degree is in composition. I'm a music historian.
Okay.
I know the history of music, and to the degree that I know the technical workings of music, it's to steal stuff from other composers that I can use in my own music. But I have no particular political road that I need to follow because of my teachers. I have no song I have to sing based on my education. And so I'm not a formal musicologist. Those folks are that's a special discipline. It's a discipline that I respect, that I steal from, but I'm glad I'm not part of.
Because they are like most academics, they are counting the number of angels on the head of a pin, and normally in order to get tenure, they're studying some microscopic aspect of Mussorgsky's teenage years, and you are an educator.
I'm a generalist. I'm a thief.
Right.
And I'm an assembler. I try to put together what I think are the coherent and most important aspects. But I also steal. And there are some brilliant musicologists whose writings are as elegant and beautiful as the music they're describing. And these are some of the most intelligent musicians I know. So one must be careful about how broad a brush we want to paint with here.
Let's play a little game. I like these little games. I'm going to mention a composer. This was not what we were all planning to do, but it just feels like fun.
Okay.
We're talking about careers in music, so this is a composer, since you're a composer. I'm going to name a famous composer, and you say the first sentence that comes to mind. It could come from a musicologist, it could come from your knowledge. One sentence, the first thing that comes to mind about that person, Frédéric Chopin.
Awesome.
Sentence. Say a sentence.
Oh, you want a whole sentence?
I want a whole sentence.
Well, I'll use the word awesome 6 times. Frédéric Chopin was a brilliant composer, French father, Polish mother, who managed to capture something of the national spirit of his nation in his music at a time when that nation was looking for nationhood.
Hence the Polonaises and things like that.
The Polonaises, the Mazurkas, and so forth, yes.
Okay, let's go chronologically. Johann Sebastian Bach.
One of 50 Bach family members who was a professional musician, but the greatest of them all. A man who was never considered in his own time. Talk about bad career. In his own day, Bach was not considered either a composer of the first, second,
wow,
or third tier.
Wow.
He was considered a great keyboard player. But his music was considered too complicated, too long, too calm, too intellectual. And so when he got the job that ultimately was his last job, 27 years in Leipzig, he was the fourth choice for the job, and no one was happy about him.
And why, in one to two sentences, why has he risen to be one of the preeminent composers of all time?
Well, he always has been one of the preeminent composers of all time.
What makes him that?
An amazing degree of technical ability coupled with a sense of taste and spirituality that puts him above and beyond pretty much all other human beings. Every now and then you get a Michael Jordan. Every now and then you get somebody who puts it all together in a way that transcends the form itself. And that was Bach.
Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
Here's another one who transcends everything else, who put it all together.
What's his differentiator from Bach?
Well, he lived at a different time, and so the tastes, what was demanded from him as a composer were very different than what was demanded from Bach. Bach was a functionary of the court and of the church. Mozart was living at a time when he could be a freelancer, and he was. In fact, it was amazing. He made his own career in a way that no one could have done even 25 years before. And Mozart was living at a time when elegant and beautiful melody was considered the preeminent aspect of musical expression.
Ludwig van Beethoven.
Beethoven, again, you want to talk about career and bring that in a little bit? Well, Beethoven was the first truly modern composer. Modern in that he said, what I think is right. The heck with the norms of the time, the heck with your ears, I don't really care what you want. I'm going to express myself. He was a very modern man in that way. And he could pull that off because he was living at a time of tremendous change. It was the time of Napoleon. It was the time of the French Revolution. And that sense of individual empowerment that had always been there during the Enlightenment now really burst forth. And Beethoven is the first modern artist in terms of music.
Tchaikovsky.
I love Tchaikovsky's music. And by the way, Tchaikovsky's favorite composer by far was Mozart. Tchaikovsky was, again, a brilliant melodist. He was also a flamboyant gay man, a cross-dresser with a taste for teenage boys, who lived in what was perhaps the most homophobic environment of recent memory, and that was Tsarist Russia. And he had to hide so much of who and what he was. But we hear it in the music. We hear a gentleness. We hear a beauty. We hear an elegance, a clarity of statement that is just fantastic.
Debussy.
Claude Debussy, French composer, born 1861, died 1918. Perhaps the most revolutionary character in 20th century music, something that many folks don't appreciate. His music's very pretty. It's very juicy. The chords he uses still sound fairly traditional, his harmonic language. But the way in which he used harmony, the way in which he used melody, totally revolutionary. He used non-Western scales. He stopped using major and minor. And as a result, he became a role model for everyone since.
John Cage.
Well, now, here's a good question. Do we want to call John Cage a composer, or do we want to call him an entrepreneur and somebody who tried to shake up the community? Cage's early music, up to about 1945, much of it for prepared piano, that is a piano that's been turned into a percussion ensemble by sticking stuff inside of it, is superb. I'm a great fan of John Cage's early music. But after that, he became something of a shaman for some and a clown for others.
Let's do Schoenberg, who is also the general public considers people like, you know, in some ways Schoenberg and Berg and John Cage and Philip Glass and all the rest of them is just weird music. But differentiate, what makes you love Schoenberg?
I do.
What makes Schoenberg rise above the rest of those?
Well, it's not that he rises above them. Again, I'm not going to be subjective. I never need to tear down one. Well, back to the difference between, frankly, and now I apologize to all my friends in academia, but one of the games I don't have to indulge in is tearing down one thing in order to elevate another, whereas that is a typical game in certain communities.
So Schoenberg.
Arnold Schoenberg was a visionary. He was a great composer in the German-Austrian tradition in that he believed in all of the things about German and Austrian music, that it should be technically accomplished, it should be expressively powerful, spiritually complex. The only thing he didn't believe in was traditional tonality. And he found a way that for him allowed him to write music of great power, great beauty, that didn't subscribe to the traditional tonal system. Unfortunately, by creating his own musical Esperanto, it distances him from the casual listener who doesn't have the time, energy, or experience to understand his particular language, which opens up the huge issue of 20th century art in general.
Like Ulysses, for example.
Ulysses or abstract expressionism in visual art. Any art that doesn't use formal structures.
Faulkner.
That we can recognize.
Right. Okay. So, you know, my board operating engineer asked an excellent question. Why did most of these genius composers die in poverty? Why were they not compensated commensurate with their abilities?
Well, first, now I'm going to, again, they didn't die in poverty.
Okay.
Bach did not die in poverty. He died in obscurity, but he wasn't a poor man.
Okay.
Mozart, this idea that Mozart died poor and was thrown in a pauper's grave, that's not true. Mozart got a third-class burial, as any middle-class person would have gotten at the time. Mm. Mozart made a lot of money. Unfortunately, Mozart always spent a buck more than he made. But at the time he died, all the money problems were going away because of the magic flute. Chopin did not die poor. Schoenberg had some problems because he had to leave Germany. He was Jewish.
Mm.
He came to the United States. He got a job teaching at UCLA. To this day, the music building in UCLA is Schoenberg Hall. But, you know, he had a hard time, and there was a lot of hostility towards him, so he didn't get the grants. He didn't get the Guggenheims. He didn't get the stuff that others would have gotten.
Mm.
But if we go through the list of composers, Beethoven did not die poor, but twice he lost all his money because of the Napoleonic invasions of Vienna. Mm. And twice all his savings were wiped out by inflation. So these people live in the same world that we live in, and they were subject to the same financial ups and downs, but none of them died poor.
It is my privilege to let you, my dear listeners, know I am talking with a guy who has exceeded even my very high expectations.
Ah.
I'm talking with Robert Greenberg, probably the world's certainly best communicating music historian, and we are talking about careers as a musician, whether it is a composer, and we will in just a moment go to as a soloist, as an orchestra member, and a conductor. But first, you know, I can't help, certainly, especially on KELW, which is so sensitized to issues of gender and race and whatever, I can't help but notice that every single one of the ones that I, so as a you know, narrowly defined, but I think these are the most famous musicians, composers, they're all white males, European, Eurocentric white males. Should I be shot?
No, sadly, we joke about them as the dead Germans or the best dead Germans who ever lived. Women were not composers in the 19th century. They weren't even musicians in the 18th and 19th centuries. They were expected to give up their aspirations and make babies and have families. And that's especially difficult to be a composer. You know, you could be a prodigy as a pianist. You could be a prodigy as a violinist. That is, at the age of 10, already be able to play repertoire. But there are no compositional prodigies. Someone could say, oh, but Mozart was writing symphonies at 6. No, Mozart's father was writing symphonies for Mozart at 6.
Made a good movie, though.
Oh, made a great movie. Mozart's father was helping him write little miniature operas at age 10 and 12. Mozart didn't start writing masterworks until he was 19 or 20 years old, after which he'd been composing for 15 years.
Mm.
There are no prodigy novelists. There are no prodigy playwrights. You need to live a certain amount of time and have a certain amount of experience before you can create hard copy that lasts.
So let us turn to...
So but I want to finish your question.
I'm so sorry.
Because you asked about women.
I was going to refocus that. So is there, I don't believe in picking, we need a woman, but is there a woman and or a person of color, ideally both in this day and age, who deserves, whether it was recognized or not, who deserves to be included among that first rank if we were purely judging on the merits?
In the 20th century, yes.
Who is that? Give me one example
All right,
of that person.
A person of color, William Grant Still. Wonderful composer. Wrote an opera that I'm crazy about. But unfortunately, given his time and place, his music has been swept under the carpet.
Even though academia today is absolutely looking under the carpet for people of color.
Oh, well, but we don't have to worry about academia because academia has virtually no impact in the performing arts community or the people who do the recordings.
Interesting.
Let's face it.
Interesting.
The symphonies and the operas are all trying to stay as, I won't even say in the black, they want to stay as far out of the red as they can.
I see.
And the way you do that is to keep your audiences happy. And the
Got
way
it.
You keep your audiences happy is to spoon feed them
the same stuff.
Correct. Spoon feed them the classics that make them want to come.
Carmina Burana.
written by, you know, Carmina Burana is an interesting...
Karl Orff, yeah.
Yeah, it's the only piece of music written by a genuine Nazi that's in the repertoire.
Wow, right.
Yeah, it's the only surviving work to come out of German fascism that's in the repertoire.
Let's go to, is there a woman? I want to elevate at least, you know, not because of affirmative action, but is there a woman who undervalued, who deserves to be in this discussion as a preeminent composer of any era, 20th century, 21st, or whatever?
Well, Ellen Zwillich and Joan Tower and Tanya Leone.
Tell me about one. Let's go a little deeper. Tell me.
Tanya Leone.
Go ahead. Tell me about her.
She's a Cuban-born composer. I guess she's in her mid-60s by now, whose music combines this extraordinary rhythmic impetus with great craft and great interest. I, for one, growing up as a rock and roll piano player and a jazz piano player, I'm always looking for the rhythmic thing. I'm looking for something that, even if the pitches are difficult, the actual sounds are difficult, I want music that moves me physically, that makes me want to dance.
You know, I feel like we're getting, you know, and it's appropriate. We're talking about this, but it seems like, you know, it's like a sexologist who's a virgin. We should be playing some music. So I think
we should. But here's a name. Here's a name I want everyone to know. Jennifer Higdon, and people will say Jennifer Higdon. Jennifer's, I guess she's in her mid-50s by now. She teaches at the Curtis Institute in Philly, which
very
is as
famous
good as it
music,
gets.
Absolutely.
She is brilliant. I've never heard a piece by her that
Jennifer
wasn't
Higdon.
Great. Jennifer Higdon. People could say, why isn't she being played? She is.
Oh, okay.
She is being played all over the place. But who pays any attention to the 20th century piece of music on the program?
Okay. We're going to do two things. We're going to now, when in our preparation for the show, we try to think of what could, while staying on the career thing, what could we do that was also going to bring music into it and not just talk. So I issued a challenge to Robert Greenberg. I said, pick the two cuts of music that somebody who's not a classical music aficionado at all, and maybe who thinks that's just a bunch of dead old white males and it's, I don't care about listening to this crap, that might entice them, might seduce them into wanting to listen more. So why don't you, the first one you've got is the Bach air on a G string. Give us the briefest introduction of that, and then she'll play it. But I want to give one bit of a suggestion. Joanne, could you, when you get some time, while he's still here, see if you could dig up any Jennifer Higdon? Is that possible? No, it's not possible. Okay. Then I encourage you, my dear listeners, after the show, Google Jennifer Higdon. Does she have a signature piece?
No, she's brilliant. The piece that I fell in love with was a string quartet, and that was about 23, 24 years ago. I heard this quartet, and it was a revelation, and it killed me because she's younger than I am, and she was younger than me at the time, and I hate when younger people do stuff better than I do. But there you go. I was in the act of writing what was my third string quartet, and I stole from her. Oh my goodness, I was so happy to find that.
Before we get to the music, one more thing. You're a composer. You say although you're world famous, truly, as a music historian and communicator, you're also a composer. Tell me something that would surprise me about being a composer.
Virtually nothing. It sucks. There's no way to make a living at it. If you want to be an effective professional composer, I think it's like being a professional politician. It's best to be born rich because there's no money in it anymore. You know,
the best way to make $1 million as a composer is to start with $2 million.
Correct. I like that. But it's the same is true if you're a novelist. The same thing is true if you're a playwright or a painter. This is something you do because first you have a passion, and second of all, you're lucky enough at some point to find out you actually have a talent for it and you're good at it, and so you can't stop. If anything has made me stop, sadly, is having four kids and certain domestic responsibilities that compel me to find money-making opportunities, of which writing music is not one.
What about sucking at the tit of Hollywood and saying, I'm going to become a music film score composer? Is that real or is that BS?
That's BS. But, of course, this is what my parents were telling me. When I went away to grad school at UC Berkeley, my mother says, listen, write a jingle. And my father says, do a movie. You know, this is like you're a pole vaulter and someone says, why don't you take up foosball? Yeah, it's they're completely different.
What's the difference? When I listened, you know, you were going to play the Mozart number 21 piano concerto, right. which is the Elvira Madigan thing. It was in right. some movie.
Right.
So why you say they're completely? Why is composing for the movies completely different than composing?
It's completely different.
Why?
Because a movie composer is someone who needs to evoke pre-existing associations in the ears of his or her listeners in a way that deepens the experience on screen without distracting you.
Hmm.
I am a composer. I write music that I want you to sit on your butt and listen to because I have something to say to you. But a movie composer is a completely different kind of person, someone who uses various styles to evoke various reactions, but never, never to distract you. The old line is true. The moment you start noticing the music, that composer in a movie has gone too far.
So we have teased your own composing. What if there was one piece you want our listeners, in addition to the Jennifer Higdon string quartet, if there is one piece of yours that you've composed that you would like our listeners after the show to Google and watch the YouTube video, it would be?
I would suggest two pieces. One called...
Not one. We're going to be
just
doing...
one. Oh, my God. Lemurs Are Afraid of Fusas.
What the hell's that mean?
This is something that I, with my daughter Lily, we were watching Dora the Explorer.
Yeah.
And there was this thing, and they observed that lemurs are afraid of fusas. Lemurs are little
What's
furry.
What's a fusa?
A fusa is a wild cat, a feral cat that eats lemurs. And it was observed that lemurs are afraid of fusas. And right. and she made up a little song, Lemurs Are Afraid of Fusas. And I thought, that would be a really cool piece to write. So it's for cello and piano, three movements.
Okay.
And there you have it. You can find it on Google it, or I've got a YouTube channel.
Awesome.
You can find it.
A listener has requested the spelling of Higdon. Is it H-I-G-D-O-N or E-N?
E-N.
E-N. H-I-G-D-E-N, Jennifer Higdon. Thank you, listener, for listening. That's great. Now, Bach's Air on a G-string, briefest of introductions before we play that cut.
Second movement from his orchestral suite of about 1730. He was so disgusted with the church authorities that he was having to work for at that point in Leipzig, he just decided he's going to start writing music for the kids at the university, Ooh. Leipzig University. Mm. So he was in charge of conducting the university band called the Collegium Musicum, and he wrote these four orchestral suites, these four pieces for orchestra, each of which consists of a bunch of dance movements. And this is an air, meaning a song. For that deep, that suite.
And this is one of the two pieces I would play that if I were on my deathbed that I'd want to be listening to. Let's hear it. You know, we live in a world that is so tainted by so much, whatever your political persuasion is, or even apart from politics, when we deal with a salesperson or even a nonprofit pitching to get you to give him his money, or even in the, you know, the multi-layered subtextual behavior of people in parties, even with our spouses, this is purity of good.
You asked me to come up with a few pieces. I mean, we could have come up, obviously, with hundreds.
Right.
That would seduce someone who wasn't a listener to music by dead people. And the reason why I chose the pieces I chose, and the reason why you chose all the pieces you chose, because, my goodness, you sent me a list of 20 pieces.
I know.
They are all marked by beautiful, memorable, elegant melody. Melody is the core of music. I mean, there are two cores of music. There's the body and the voice. Body is dance music, stuff that stimulates us to move or to march or to work together as a group. And voice music, song, is music that has the lyric impact of one person speaking to another. And these two complementary aspects, body and voice, are the soul of music. And elegant, gorgeous melody is universal. I think no matter what our cultures are, we react as Homo sapiens to the voice of someone speaking to us. And that's what drove my selections. And whether you realized it or not, that's precisely what drove your selections as well.
Lest you think that all classical music is about lyricism, the first of the two pieces that I selected is completely different. But I first want to let our listeners know you are listening to Robert Greenberg, my very special guest here on Work with Martin & Co., the most preeminent musical educator, classical music educator, probably on the planet. And I'm keeping him the whole hour. Because you don't very often get. I find myself sometimes, I'm always thinking, my dear listeners, about you. And I'm asking, is the time best spent doing workovers on you, talking to my guest, or me spewing some hot air? I'm clear, there is no ambivalence in my mind, that you are best served by listening to Robert Greenberg for another half hour. So just so you know, if you're expecting to call in for workover, that'll be next week, not this week. Okay, so now, the piece that I have chosen is very different. It is from a guy you've described who is written by a guy who you consider the ultimate egotist, Leonard Bernstein. And this is the New York City Opera Symphony Orchestra playing the overture to Candide. Okay, what you were listening to that, what were you feeling or thinking?
Well, it's fantastic dance music, and it's incredibly engaging. I was thinking that, yes, Bernstein was an amazing egoist, but he was also probably the greatest musician ever born in the United States. So his ego was founded on real-world abilities. He was also the post-World War II poster child for the media. The guy never went anywhere without a camera crew, mm-hmm. without movie cameras. We could follow his life to its smallest minutia, just looking at the moving pictures of him from the time he was in his early 20s to the time he died. Fascinating character, wonderful composer, would have been a really great composer, I believe, had he not constantly needed this endless love and adulation, which drove him to be the kind of public person that a professional composer cannot be.
How much was it that he was one of the first gay conductors to come out flamboyantly? How much did that help or hurt him?
I don't think it hurt him at all. By the time he came out, of course, he was bi. He had already been married. Mm. He had fathered children. He came out, by the time he came out, what, in the 70s? I don't think anyone cared. Mm. You know, this is an interesting story, and if you'll allow me just to redirect it. Back to Tchaikovsky, living in the 1880s, 1890s, constantly terrified. I mean, living in existential terror that he will be outed, convinced that it will be his death and the death of everyone around him who he loved. Well, the fact, and there's still talk. It's not entirely substantiated, but there's still talk that he was forced to commit suicide because otherwise his gayness was going to be revealed to the Tsar himself. Mm. No one would have cared. No one would have cared. Hmm. Tchaikovsky was a national hero based on his art. No one would have cared. You know, the fear we all feel for ourselves is often so overblown relative to reality. And if I could say anything to Peter Tchaikovsky right now, if it was 1893 and he was about to do something extreme, I would say, dude, you got another 20 great years ahead of you. Everyone loves you. Everyone's going to love you. Mm-hmm. The Tsar loves you. No one's going to hassle you. Just chill out, have another vodka, and write another piece of music.
Perfect. Now, I think any discussion of gay anybody's in the classical music world would be incomplete, especially here in San Francisco, without mentioning Michael Tilson Thomas. Thomas, what do you want to say about Michael Tilson Thomas?
Nothing.
Interesting. Tell me more.
Well, he's a wonderful conductor.
That sounds like there's a pregnancy in that. Is there
I've had certain contacts that are best left undiscussed on the air, but happily shared privately.
Okay, fair enough. This might be a good time to transition our conversation into the interaction between the conductor and the soloist. And in our part of our preparation for this show, you sent me the most amazing exchange that occurred between Leonard Bernstein and one of the preeminent pianists, the most intellectually rich and wonderfully tasteful deep pianist, Glenn Gould. Tell us the story.
Well, the story is this was a concert in 1962 in New York when Bernstein was principal at the New York Philharmonic. Gould, as you properly said, was one of the most deep-thinking pianists of the 20th century, but very iconoclastic.
Right.
Did a lot of stuff that others didn't agree with, but he was so brilliant and thoughtful that you had to listen to it. Anyway, they were going out to perform the Brahms' first piano concerto, and Bernstein came on stage.
This is, by the way, an iconic piece of music that many people who certainly right. subscribe have heard a lot of times,
right.
and they're used to hearing certain tempos and certain dynamics continue.
Right. And Bernstein comes out on stage. And by the way, my friends, everyone can listen to this. If you go to just Google Leonard Bernstein, Glenn Gould, New York Phil, you can hear what Bernstein said. And what he said was he came out and basically disavowed all knowledge of the performance as it was going to take place. Basically, he said, Glenn Gould and I do not see eye to eye here. We're going to play this the way Glenn Gould wants to play it. But he proceeded to very gently but very certainly eviscerate Maestro Gould, who did not have a chance to respond, but merely then had to come out on stage with everyone staring at him, Bernstein having said, the choices here are not mine. Oh, we'll do them because Glenn is brilliant, but it's been a very difficult week and blah, blah, blah. You don't do stuff like that. I mean, from a professional point of view, you don't do stuff like
that.
What
if I say I disagree? I think that classical music has become too studied, almost like a Baroque, like a Mozartian ritual, like a minuet where everything is completely orchestrated, almost like marionettes. I think what's needed is debate. And I think the best thing that could have been done is for him to say that and then Glenn Gould to come out and say why he disagreed and then play little bits of it and say, see, that Brahms, who's supposed to be the ultimate, the authority here because he wrote the damn thing, but there should be this debate, it seems to me, between here is where, I mean, if I'm Bernstein, and it's easy to have the 2020 hindsight, I come out and I say, Brahms said it should be played at this kind of a tempo and with this kind of volume. And it should be played like this. Orchestra, play it. Oh, and Gould. And then Gould says, but this is why I think we should play it this way. And then I would have the audience raise their hand and say, which do you think is better and why? That's the kind of non-ritualistic engagement that I think might keep the very problem from your saying, which is that they're worried about going too far into the red. That could keep classical music alive. What do you really think, Robert Greenberg?
I agree with that 100%, but that's not what happened.
Right.
Leonard Bernstein came out and dissed his soloist, distanced himself from the interpretation, and didn't give equal time. If you want to start a debate, make it a debate. Every story has two sides, at very least, and we only heard one, and that's what I object to.
Right, and that, of course, that's an outlier. Most times what goes on is there are wars, there is internecine warfare between the conductor and the soloist.
And the orchestra.
And the orchestra. We'll get to the orchestra, taking in pairwise comparisons. But it occurs during rehearsal.
Correct.
Paint a picture for me for the kind of debate that would occur between a conductor and soloist in rehearsal.
In an ideal world, the conductor and a soloist sit down before the rehearsal, discuss tempos, that is the speed that their different sections will be performed, balances. The soloist will show the conductor how he or she intends to play certain passages, and then they go out and they collaborate, because all music making, unless you're a soloist, it's the ultimate collaborative act. And then you find a medium by which everyone has been able to contribute his or her interpretive ideas. Now, sometimes that doesn't happen. I'll tell you a very famous story. Arthur Schnabel,
right,
great pianist Beethoven of the mid-20th pianist, century, right. Beethoven pianist, correct. He's on stage in a rehearsal of one of the Beethoven concerti, I don't know which one, and the conductor is Otto Klemperer.
Six foot five,
yeah. Teutonic. Oh, Klemperer's it's a great story because, again, a Jew who escaped the Nazis in 33 ended up in the United States, lived the life of the expatriate conductor. His son, Werner Klemperer, is famous for having played Colonel Klink on Hogan's Heroes. That is a Nazi. Go figure. These things, you couldn't make these
things. But Otto was an autocrat. He was as autocratic as a Nazi, but he was a Jew.
Exactly. And so, of course, if you imagine the stage during a concerto, the pianist is sitting behind the conductor at the very front of the stage. Well, Klemperer was apparently conducting in his usual leisurely fashion, way too slow. And so Schnabel started conducting with his finger, and the orchestra's following Schnabel.
I love it.
Because they like Schnabel's speed. So at some point, Klemperer turns around, sees what Schnabel's doing, throws the score on the floor, and booms out, "Schnabel!" pounding himself on the chest. "The conductor is here!" And Schnabel shrugs and says, "And the pianist is here. But where is poor Beethoven?"
Mm-hmm.
And this is an extreme case of, and it goes back to the Glenn Gould. See, here's my problem with Bernstein. When you listen to that thing, Bernstein, in talking to the audience, was saying, it's always an interesting question, who's in charge in a concerto, the composer or the pianist? But of course, neither one of them is in charge. The composer is in charge. Brahms is in charge, and it's their job to try to figure out what Brahms had to say.
What if I'm going to say that's wrong? And I'm not sure I agree with, but this is a point I think I may agree with, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Brahms wrote this in 1886 or whatever it was.
1850s.
That was of its time and its era. And he is one person. We live in an era of crowdsourcing, where if I were to be playing the Brahms First Piano Concerto now, I could hear all, and if I am the soloist, this is a piece I'm probably playing in a number of orchestras, whereas the conductor is only conducting at this one time, then he's going to move on to the 9,000 other things in the repertoire. I have spent years studying, since 1860, whatever. I have seen Franz Liszt play it. I've seen Rachmaninoff play it. I've seen Schnabel play it. I've seen Stephen Hough play it. I've seen all of these really great, Daniel Kovacevic, Christian Zimmermann play it. The great, great pianists. And I can incorporate, I can listen and think, because I have to play this again and again. My playing in the year 2017 is going to incorporate the best ideas and the best feelings of hundreds of great composers, of great pianists, none of which the conductor has time to do. So should not really the final decision reside in the soloist?
I was taught when I studied conducting that it's always the soloist, that you follow the soloist. As an accompanist, and I'm a piano player, as an accompanist, it is your job to accompany your singer.
Right.
And to be sensitive to the needs of a singer or a violinist. So, first of all, yes, it should always be up to the soloist. And again, Bernstein, coming out and giving that speech, went way over the line without giving Gould a chance to respond. What I will say is there is a tremendous amount of interpretive latitude that is possible. You know, John Gielgud and Derek Jacobi and Laurence Olivier are all going to play Macbeth differently. They're all going to do it differently. And they're all going to do it legitimately based on a history of experience and the wealth of knowledge they bring to it. But at what point does interpretive license go too far? Now, I'm not saying Glenn Gould went too far now, but I'm bringing up an important point. At what point do you recompose? At what point have you wiped out the spirit, the sensibility? What happens if you decide to cast a teenager as King Lear? Is it any longer a legitimate interpretive choice? Are you rewriting because your ego as a producer or director or composer has now become more important than the ego of the creator? And that's what I'm talking about. There is a line. There's a line that one must be careful not to cross.
But I think we never get close to that line. I think if you listen to two very different players, for example, I love Gaspard de la Nuit from Ravel, and the most iconoclastic, to use your word, performance is that of Ivo Pogorelich, and yet the most mainstream, but also first class, is Marta Argerich's. If you listen to those, and those are polar extremes, to 99.99% of the audience listening to that, they're going to seem very similar. The differences are going to be seen as trivial. Is it worth even arguing about this, let alone on KELW radio?
Yes, it is.
Why?
I wish we had to. Now, here's something. Now, you got to bring me back. You got to bring me back, because here's what I'm going to play for you. I'm going to play for you Otto Klemperer's performance of Beethoven's Third Symphony from 1961. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to listen to John Elliott Gardiner's performance from 1991-94. Here's what we're going to hear. Beethoven wrote across the top of the Eroica, the Third Symphony, dotted half note equals 60, which means it's supposed to go roughly ya-da-dee-da-dee-da-da-dee-da-dum. But Klemperer decides to play it at 48. Mm-hmm. Ya da dee da 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 da. Now, which is more legitimate? We know what Beethoven's Third is about. It's about a heroic character, meaning Beethoven himself, who is aspiring to battle his demons. Demons in the music projected by rhythmic ambiguity and dissonance. Well, in Klemperer's version, we hear none of that machismo. We hear none of the energy. We hear none of the heroic spirit that Beethoven, in his scenario for this piece, built in. We lose entirely the storyline that we know the Third is about. And instead, it simply becomes a vehicle for Klemperer's flawed vision. It becomes about Klemperer, and Beethoven's scenario is destroyed. And there's a case of crossing the line.
Maybe. I think it's replacing what was Beethoven's image of a more strong, forward-moving character with the distinctiveness and the sobriety that comes. I mean, I would be equally eager in a different way to listen to both of those. But now we're getting into the weeds. So let's go back to music. Joanne, I think we're ready for our next pair. So introduce the next piece you've got. It's a Mozart clarinet concerto.
Adagio. Oh my goodness! There's way too much to talk about it. I'll keep it quiet. This is Mozart's Kerschel 622. That is the Kerschel catalog of Mozart's music 622. That information is significant.
Why?
Because the unfinished piece at the end of his life was 626, the Requiem.
So this is the end.
Mozart finished this concerto about 6 weeks before he died.
And he died like about 38 or something like that?
He was 35 years old and 11 months, correct. Mm-hmm. He died on December 5th of 1791. And this piece was finished in mid-October. Mm-hmm. It is gorgeous. Mozart is the single composer who brought the clarinet into the solo repertoire.
It's a tough job, man. Clarinet is not the most pleasant.
It's so beautiful. And people who play clarinet are the coolest people in the world.
How are they different from a flutist, say, for example?
Well, you got to
remember, which is not a flautist, by the way. It's a
flutist. Thank you.
Yes.
A clarinet has a very wide reed, and so this you can do make tremendous variety of sounds with a clarinet, depending on how hard you put your lips on the reed, how far in the ligature you put your mouth. Clarinet has a voice-like flexibility that's unique among all orchestral instruments. You really can make it sound like anything. If you ever want to hear clarinet sounding like a human voice, listen to a good klezmer clarinet player, because that's part of the klezmer tradition.
That's the MIDI. That's the 18th century, very traditional Jewish European, Eastern European,
Eastern and Central European Jewish dance music. So, Mozart fell in love with a clarinetist named Anton Stadler, who was just a miracle worker. And Mozart wrote a series of clarinet works that are still the basis of the entire clarinet repertoire.
But why are the
for
people?
Stadler.
Why are the people? Who you say are clarinetists are cooler than, say, an oboist or a flutist?
Most people are cooler than oboists, and now I'm gonna go places we don't want to go. All right, you're telling me to go. All right,
yeah.
Listen, musical instruments are like any other job in the world, and now finally we're talking about careers. Okay, every one of us, God bless us, we have different skill sets. It's evolution. we're supposed to be as varied as possible so that the species contains as much genetic information as possible. So everyone's got a different skill set, and depending on our skill set, we will hopefully find an occupation that maximizes that skill set and allows us to do the best we can. And everyone's different. Well, that's true with musicians as well. Someone who plays the oboe is a very different kind of person than someone who plays a clarinet.
Of course, there's great diversity, but tell me, what is the most common set of characteristics among an oboist? Here's your challenge. Oboist, flute, any three you want. Pick any three instruments you want, including piano. What is a legitimate, relatively generalizable assertion?
And I'm apologizing up front now. So you don't need to send me hate mail. You don't need to bomb my house. You don't need to identify it as an ISIS headquarters. The oboe is an amazingly demanding instrument. You've got a tiny little double reed, that is two little reeds, very thin, that are bound together. Oboists have to carve their own reeds. You can buy them, but most oboists make their own reeds. They're very anal retentive people. Who else wants to sit there with this tiny little X-Acto knife hours at a time making their reeds? Then you have to bind them to the mouthpiece and then somehow push enough air into this darn thing to even make a squeak. I would suggest to you that in order to create that pressure, your entire brain is being pushed backwards against your skull cap. Oboists have migraine headaches. Mm. They suffer from all kinds of nasal issues to play that instrument.
Wow.
What kind of person wants to suffer for that long? What kind of person wants to spend 2 years just making a legitimate sound on the instrument? What kind of fourth or fifth or sixth grader is willing to do that? I can tell you none of my kids would have been willing or able to do that. You've got to have someone with an amazing sense of concentration, an amazing desire to do something, an attention to detail, and anal retentiveness. So oboe players can be fussy.
And can they, are they, they're, you know, very
fussy.
Many great literary people, you know, are writers. They love to, they feel they need to suffer. You know, I reminded of Kafka's thing called The Hunger or something, where, you know, this writer had to deliberately starve himself literally for like days and days. Are these self-abnegating ascetic people?
Some of them that I know, yes. Not all. Again, one wants to be careful that we keep on the side of humor with these generalizations and stereotypes I'm making now. But they hold forth accurately more often than not. Certainly, the kind of person who plays the oboe would never want to play the cello. The cello is the sexiest instrument in the orchestra. I mean, you get to wrap your legs around it, for goodness sake, and all the vibrations are going right into your body. The cello is a glamour instrument in that it gets to play principal melody much of the time. It's a beautiful instrument to listen to. You know, when there's a movie about some young musician, it's always a cellist because it's so damn sexy and it sounds great. A different kind of person plays the cello. A piano is not an orchestral instrument. If you want to be a pianist, you're approaching the world very differently. And again, I'll give you an illustration. I was married to a flute/piccolo player for many years. And I, you know, she passed, and that was a terrible tragedy. She was a professional grade flute player. Well, we'd go to the orchestra. We'd go to the San Francisco Symphony. What does she listen to? Is she listening to the piece? No, she's listening to Paul Rienzi, who used to be the principal flute player.
Of course. Who
wouldn't? Or she'd be listening to Tim Day.
Of course she would.
She'd listen to Tim Day, who was her teacher. Mm-hmm. Because flute players listen to flute players. Whereas a pianist like me, I'm listening to everything because a piano player plays everything. I don't just play a single part. I play foreground, middle ground, background. I'm having to hear the whole piece. And so I'm not focused on any one instrument. I'm asked all the time, why are conductors almost always piano players originally? And that's because two reasons. One, a pianist is used to hearing everything, and a pianist is used to having to make his or her own interpretive decisions at every second. If a piano player is playing a Beethoven sonata, you're not following a conductor. You have to interpret yourself, whereas a flute player from the earliest days has been following leadership.
Okay, let's let our listeners know we've been teasing you about the Mozart clarinet. Let me explain. I want our listeners to know yet again, you're listening to a very special edition of Work with Marty Nemco. I have a wonderful guest. If you're just joining us, please, this guy is awesome.
He takes a field which is arid, typically classical music, and he makes it fecund. He makes it fertile. And he's terrific. And I just think also our chemistry between us is good, so it results in a good conversation. But in any case, he is Robert Greenberg. And before any time goes past, he is the preeminent teacher of music. If you like to study both the structure of music, the stories, the biographies, as well as lots of pieces of music, he's got two brand new courses that are his two huge passions. One is called Mozart in Vienna. You could just Google Mozart in Vienna and Greenberg. And the music of the 20th century. If you're one of those people who finds Schoenberg or Berg or any of those people just, you know, out of comprehension, and you would like to expand your horizons, you will never do better than to check those out. Mozart in Vienna and the music of the 20th century. Those are two separate, very affordable courses, Jesus, compared to what you pay if you go to a university, bizarrely cheaper.
So anything is cheaper.
Yeah, exactly. But now, let us now, without further ado, let us play a segment of Mozart's, the Adagio movement of Mozart's clarinet concerto. You were whispering to me something while that was playing. Please, why don't you continue?
I just want to mention why clarinetists are cool. Why the kind of person who wants and can play a clarinet is a collaborative, interesting person. If you look at the wind ensemble in an orchestra, you've got piccolo, flutes, oboes, English horn, which is basically a big oboe, the bassoons, and the clarinets. Because of the flexibility of the clarinet, which I was talking about before, the voice-like flexibility and the fact that you can inflect pitch ever so slightly, it is more than any other of those instruments. It's the job of the clarinet, which is pitched right in the middle of all those instruments, to make sure that everyone stays in tune. It's up to the clarinet to blend with the instruments above it, meaning the oboes and the flutes, and to blend with the instruments below it, meaning the bassoons and the bass clarinet. And so they have to be very flexible. They have to have great ears. They have to be able to bring everything in tune around them. They have to be conciliators, and they have to be flexible. And that's a certain kind of person.
Say, remember we played this little dueling, our favorite pieces, for the uninitiated or the turned off to classical music. It may be self, and you can say it's self-evident. For me, this is surreal. That's the wrong word. For me, it is pure beauty to listen to that. That's that adagio of the Mozart clarinet concerto. Is there anything you want to add to that? Or I wanted to go to the phones and take one call.
Absolutely.
Let's go to the phones. Okay. So we have very little time, but I've made the decision that it is worth talking with Robert rather than taking a lot of calls, but I at least want to give you, my dear listeners, one shot. So if you have any question or comment about the career of a classical musician, orchestra member, soloist, or conductor, this is the time to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, with my very special guest, Robert Greenberg, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And of course, before I say anything, the phones are ringing, so let's go right to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. What is your question or comment for Robert Greenberg?
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, I'm calling because I'm the president of a board of a local community orchestra.
Yay!
And
bless you.
From Parnassus in San Francisco. And we're always struggling with attracting audiences. And I wondered if you had any suggestions for increasing our audience numbers.
Robert?
Or me? I do. And it's a different model. It's a model that I've done, that I do with San Francisco Performances, with the Alexander String Quartet. It's something that I did with the Hartford Symphony for many years in Connecticut. You know, we've got to deliver fun information with the music. And I'm a huge believer in putting someone like me on stage, collaborating with the conductor, talking about the music succinctly but clearly, offering musical examples, and then performing the piece. It works, mm-hmm. and I've done it, and it does work. The problem, the challenge, is A, conductors. Even the marginal megalomania of most conductors precludes them from ever wanting to share the stage with somebody else who's talking about the music. And orchestras mm-hmm. as well, they want to play. You know, they're holding their instruments. They're on stage to play. They're not on stage to listen to some highfalutin somebody talk to them about the music. So in order to get people to buy into these new ways of approaching things, first you need buy-in from the conductor and from the performers.
I want to add something. I am a huge believer in interactivity. There is something too passive and too orchestrated and scripted with sitting your butt in a chair for 2 hours, no matter how beautiful the music is. So I think the only reason to bring people together is to interact with them. And so I like having activities where they get to vote for which of two kinds of interpretations, which we talked about this earlier on the show. So they raise their hand. We're gonna try the first movement of the Grieg Piano Concerto in two different ways. You tell me which you like better, and we'll take questions. Which you like better and why. That's only one example. But to the extent to which you create an experience that is interactive, I think you will bring more people.
I'm not sure I would do that, speaking for myself.
Good.
You know, this is a very Eurocentric performing organization with a leader, the conductor. I'm not sure I want the troops in the audience taking over. But there is a way to present the music. You know, the main thing for me, always, is context, is to remember that this music was written by people just like us, for people just like us. And there's nothing removed from our culture. This music is all very recent. So the main thing is to create a context, to bring people closer to it, to give them a little ownership of it. And however we can do that, I believe that's the key.
We are out of time, but I love your call. So thank you very much, and I wish you all of the best. By the way, a plug, by the way, the Oakland Civic Orchestra is doing Beethoven's Fifth. I forgot a couple of other things. Today, it's free, so just look at Oakland's Civic Orchestra. But I have to end with one of only a few seconds, but I have to. Why, in an era of where everybody is dealing with exigencies, what they have to do, why is music important?
Music is something we're hardwired to do. It's an intensification of dance, and it's an intensification of language itself. We are better when we listen to music. We collaborate better when it's through music. It's something that makes us human.
And you have enriched my life in a very human, as well as intellectual, as well as affective way. Robert Greenberg, it has been a special privilege, maybe one of the best. When people will ask me what is the best shows I've ever done on the show on this 28 years, it will be the interview with Robert Greenberg.
Thank you so much, Marty.
Don't forget, if you want to take courses, he's got two amazing, I would say F, I use the word F all the time off the air, F amazing courses, Mozart in Vienna, and the music of the 20th century, I can commend it to you with no greater fervor. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, professional as always. Thank you, Joanne. And, of course, all of you for listening and your call. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers and making career decisions after 50. Should you try to hang on? If so, how? Try an encore career? Retire? And do what? I'll explore all of those with my wife, who, like me, is over 50. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.